Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:06 PM, the Pacific Summer Time. Today is October 23rd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with the Dow Gold ratio over the course of the last century, because I think it's emblematic of just how much things have changed this year. When we go back and think about a price relationship that lasted more than a century and it had such incredible cyclicality, then it does beg the question, what has happened to change it? Because we've had a very profound change. If we think about what the consistency of this long-term relationship represented, there were approximately 35 years between the peaks. Each of the peaks was higher than the last. And when we did get a bottom, then it moved meaningfully higher without a significant retest of the low the first time. We had a brief spike higher in the period from approximately 1974 to 76, and then it continued lower all the way down to 1980. And it would be tempting to think that what we've just seen today, or at least this year, is a repeat of that kind of move that we've seen in the early 1970s. And it might be. Who's to say that maybe this entire move upwards in equities from 2011 all the way through until the peak on a Dow Gold ratio basis in 2018 wasn't similar to the rebound we had in the early 1970s, except for the fact that it's multiples in terms of duration and also moved significantly more. We have to remember this is a ratio, and when you're talking about the number of times the index is greater than the price of gold, then one, just a single point on the index represents a very significant move in either or both of the underlying instruments. But the big picture and the big question is, has this significant pullback in the ratio that we've seen this year, or at least over the last 18 months, is that representative of a change of trend? Is gold going to outperform the Dow Jones Industrial Average over the course of the next decade? That's the potential, because certainly we had a crash in equities in the in 1929, and it bottomed relative to gold, at least, in 1932. So it was a three-year decline. But then we had a very lengthy process of unwinding equity outperformance from about 1966 all the way down to 1980, so 14 years, and then from the peak in 1999 all the way down to 2011 was 11 years. So if we're in a new commodity-led bull market, then it could potentially last a decade. And then considering the fact that the rebound we've had subsequent to the last big commodity bull market petering out was shorter in duration than the big secular bull trends that we've had in the past, well, it does beg a lot of questions. I think the most important of those is whether the Dow Jones is still representative of the economy or whether other indices are. And I think that is perhaps the one of the most important questions. And it does get to the root of an additional question that people are asking today, which is, what's the appropriate way of accounting for intangible assets? Well, I think it's reasonable to conclude that the NASDAQ has probably got more intangible assets than the Dow Jones does. And it's certainly more heavily laden with technology companies. And when we then think about the shape of the chart and the trend up from the lows in the period from about 2012 onwards, well, it's still a reasonably consistent trend. So we can see here then that we have got some clear changes. There's a definite change of trend. If we then think about gold. Well, is gold truly representative of a commodity bull market, or is it more about the question of how much the purchasing power of fiat currencies is being trusted by investors? Those are two very different, although related, questions. So we can then think about the Nasdaq versus the continuous commodity index. The continuous commodity index has certainly started to pick up of late, but the Nasdaq has massively outperformed the commodity complex more generally over the course of the last few years. And this is very clearly conforming to what we would anticipate to occur in a secular bull market. It's very similar and certainly not even as steep as the move that we had in the 1990s. Then we had a profound change of trend where the continuous commodity index outperformed by well in excess of 4 times relative to the Nasdaq in the subsequent decade. Now, the important point, of course, is that the Nasdaq is still going up, and we've had a very small pause over the course of the last while, but there is no real evidence yet that this trend has, in fact, reversed. Then I think it's also worth looking at the oil price instead of looking at the Dow Gold, but look at Dow Oil. Well, then we get perhaps an additional way of looking at the market, because oil prices obviously collapsed in March, and that represented a spike higher for anything compared to it. But in this occasion, we do have the very same long-term history as we do with the Dow Gold ratio, and we also have the sequence of higher reaction lows, and well, we have the higher reaction lows since 2008. We certainly have the higher highs since 1929, and provided it holds the 600-point level, then we're still in a bull market overall. So there is the potential that what we have in fact seen is a change, and perhaps that it's the stock market is still doing well. Commodities may be on the cusp of turning around, but gold is being revalued as an asset against the potential that the purchasing power of fiat currencies is going to come under significant pressure, and perhaps more pressure than it did back in the early 2000s. In fact, I think it's reasonably logical to conclude that it was the cutting of interest rates, the massive assistance that was provided to the financial markets in the aftermath of the tech bubble busting in the early 2000s that set up the conditions for the housing bubble to evolve and subsequently for the banking sector globally to collapse, then for even more money to be provided in the aftermath of the credit crisis, which has created this phenomenal bull market in companies that have a promise of making future cash flows, but perhaps aren't particularly effective at generating them in the near term. And now we have seen ourselves into this pandemic where there has been an absolutely, or I guess a multiple of the quantity of money that had been provided previously. So back in 2009, 10, 11, the quantity of money being provided as assistance to the global economy was viewed as unprecedented. Today, it's again being viewed as unprecedented. We're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars. And indeed, euros, pounds, francs, yen, and renminbi. So this is really quite a profound change. And it has contributed to massive accumulation of assets on central bank balance sheets. So that trend is by far the most important globally because it's the measure of global liquidity. and it is still trending higher. So we're up now to 28.5 trillion. And global liquidity has jumped about 8.5 trillion in a year. So with 8.5 trillion, you can still buy a bull market. And that is exactly what has happened. But there are a couple of caveats, of course, that some of the faith that investors have in the value of currencies is obviously under significant threat. One thing that we've certainly seen is that deficits have massively increased. So the USA, on if you add together the budget balance and the current account balance, the deficit is up to 17.5%. And that obviously begs questions about how on earth is all that money ever going to be paid back. For Canada, it's not that much different. It's the same with Brazil. They're all well into the high teens in terms of their overall deficits. But even when we go to the comparatively small deficits, not by comparison, like the UK or South Africa, we're still talking about 10% of GDP. And this is extraordinarily large relative to history, and you have to go back to wartime in order to really look at what the magnitude of the assistance programs that have been implemented this year amount to. So that's, I think, one of the more significant factors. It's, I think, a key reason why the Dow Gold ratio looks so much different to those other ratios. Now, when we then think about what has this massive accumulation of money represented? Well, the first thing is that it has robbed savers. So I thought this was a particularly interesting graphic, and it's from JP Morgan Asset Management. If you had $100,000 in savings, you're probably earning about $220 a year from interest, but you probably need more like $1,700 just to compensate you for inflation. And the problem, of course, is that it's not new. This, in fact, has been going on since the tech bubble burst in the early 2000s. We had a very brief period in 2005, 6, and 7 when it was possible to earn an interest rate, and then that period ended. So now we have had more than a decade of time where it was literally impossible to combat inflation by simply staying in cash. And I'm very much reminded of when I was still in college. I paid for myself going through college by working on a tour boat during the summers. And the old gentleman who owned the boat, he had taken a big speculation to stop rowing and to buy the tour boat. And he always said that you had to speculate to accumulate. Well, unfortunately, what's happened in the world today is that people don't have a choice. They have to speculate. And if they don't, they are going to see that their savings are eventually eroded by inflation. And this is in what is euphemistically called a low inflation environment, or a decade where there hasn't been any inflation. But the reality is that there are sources of inflation everywhere. One of the most important has been medical care inflation. And that is way above anything that is comparable in the rest of the economy. And this type of robbing savers of the opportunity to make a return is a truly global phenomenon. It's been codified in China's financial system, for example, where there is this wide differential between the deposit rate and the lending rate. So investors there are also attuned to speculation, which is why they put most of their money into property and why the stock market there tends to be spiky in terms of the kind of activity that it engenders. And perhaps that is also what we are now being treated to in the rest of the world, because it's very simple that investors have no choice but to speculate. Well, what of course that means is that when you speculate, you're going to be investing in companies that do well, but it doesn't necessarily mean that every company that does well is in fact making money. And what I find particularly interesting is that the number of zombies that appeared in the early 2000s and late 1999 has been exceeded in almost every year since then because of the extraordinarily low interest rate environment. And then in 2020, it has even exceeded any of the peaks that were produced before that. And of course, that is all because of the incredibly low interest rate environment. And when we look at the success of companies that don't make any money, well, we can also conclude that that's the right thing to do, is to think about momentum and the potential for market share capture, for the progression of technology and new ways of doing things. All of these types of growth strategies, they work wonderfully in a low interest rate environment because there is a very low hurdle rate in terms of the interest rate. There is massive availability of credit. What we've seen over the course of the last year has been massive interest in ETFs and, or excuse me, in IPOs. And the IPO index, since the low in March, is up just about 150%. So that's really spectacular for an index of IPOs. Unfortunately, the IPO index that Bloomberg used to have and had more history in it is not as, or perhaps they have brought it back. There we go. Now, when we look at the performance of the index over the course of the last while, obviously this is a cumulative index, and IPOs have been doing spectacularly well this year. One thing we've also seen is that the number of new deals has exploded in this year. So it is, we're getting a lot more companies that are using special purpose acquisition corporations. I think that's the acronym, SPACs, that have been used to come to market. This is a booming industry in 2020. It's substantially larger than it was in the period up to 2008. But it's probably nowhere near what it was in the period up to 1999. And the reality there, and unfortunately, when we look at this incredible performance, I think it is relevant to also ensure that we are somewhat fair and look at M2, because it's a very similar trajectory. And the reality is that the quantity of money that exists today is multiples of what it was back in 1999. So when we start to compare the size of companies today, or we compare the record size of new IPOs as they come to market, it has to at least be in the context of the value of the shrinking dollars. And that's, I think, particularly relevant as we see that companies like Ant Financial and Airbnb are likely to list next week. It could be in the order of $500 trillion worth of supply coming into the market. This has also been a year in which buybacks have certainly been hit. Although one thing we are certainly seeing, and I thought it was particularly interesting this week, is that a number of industrial companies are at the point where they are now starting to buy back their shares again. And that, I think, also helps to highlight that industrials are among the bigger beneficiaries of the amount of liquidity that's been pumped into the market. If we are looking at a global reflation, then industrials should do well. And it's quite likely that we are looking at a reflation. I think one thing that's worth thinking about is we've had this incredible environment this year, and it's been very debilitating to sentiment. But we've also seen that companies and funds have taken advantage of the extremely low interest rate environment, and they have pushed the maturity wall on their debt further out. So the maturity wall on high yield debt and leveraged loans was a significant potential problem in 2021 and 2022. But because of this incredible amount of liquidity and the ability to draw down on revolvers without actually using them, with the ability to go off and issue a whole pile of debt on the understanding that if no one else wanted it, the Federal Reserve would buy it, and the same sort of activity elsewhere, what that has allowed companies to do is to push out the maturity wall. So we don't have to worry about a lot of debt coming due in the short term. And that's very positive because it's maturing debt is one of the biggest headwinds for highly levered companies. If they don't have to deal with the pressure of having to refinance until perhaps 2024, 25, or 26, then what that suggests is that we have a reasonably large runway for companies to continue to perform or at least to exist. And of course, there is then the potential that the quantity of outstanding debt will increase even further before the maturity wall becomes an issue. I think that's one of the more important points, that the credit situation has improved. Now, when we then think about, well, how are high yield bonds doing? Well, the reality is that they were looking rather risky back at the end of 2018. Then they came all the way back down. We saw spreads push all the way out to 10%, 1,000 basis points over investment grade in March. That came not even halfway as high as they did in 2008, and since then the yield has come straight back down again, or excuse me, the spread has come straight back down again. Well, as long as high yield spreads continue to trend downwards, then it would be difficult to conclude that we're in a difficult environment for the high yield sector. And I think that's an additional point that people have been particularly worried about. Well, then when we think about the kinds of companies that are loss making, well, when we think about small caps, the S&P 600 is the small cap index. The percentage with negative trailing EPS is on par with what we had in 2008 and also in the aftermath of the tech boom. But if it's turning now, and if small caps are starting to do better, and the credit cycle is starting to come off the lows, and maturity walls have been pushed forward, then it's reasonable to conclude that we are at the beginning of a new credit cycle. And what we've certainly seen is that the number of companies with negative trailing EPS does tend to trend down again after it gets up to these extraordinary levels above 20%. Then I think there was another graphic I saw in here this week, and it was also relevant to this exact same discussion, and it is the performance of small caps relative to large caps, but over the course of a century. And in that time, there has been a clear succession of higher reaction lows. Well, small caps are very levered to domestic growth, and if that's the case, if small caps are starting to turn around, then or at least in back in areas of potential support, then that is also positive for the economic recovery. Now, in the US presidential election debate yesterday. The two candidates had a lot to say, but I thought one thing that was interesting is that President Trump said that we're coming to the end and we're on the cusp of turning the corner with the fight against the coronavirus. And Joe Biden said that we're looking at a long, dark winter, and that potentially it might even be 2022 before we get to a point where we don't have to worry about masks anymore. Well, that's two very different ways of thinking about what the potential is. But I think it's important then to look at some of the relevant charts. So when, for example, we look at the Russell 2000, it's held a sequence of higher reaction lows off the nadir in March. It had really serially underperformed for the previous 2 years, but it is now pushing on to test the highs from 2018 and 2019. The small cap index is hasn't performed quite as well, but it is now back on a recovery high and looking right quite firm, having now steadied from the region of the trend mean. If we look at other small cap indices, the AIM 100 in the UK is exhibiting a very similar trajectory, and this is very clear commonality across the Atlantic. And the index is at least steady in the region of the peaks over the course of the last nearly 2 years. If it can continue to firm from here, well, then I think it's reasonable that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Then, when we think about Japan, the small cap index there, the second section, is steadying in the region of the trend mean, and it has also been underperforming for the last 2 years, having peaked in 2018. So there is certainly a lot of commonality in small cap sectors internationally, and small caps do tend to be rather sensitive to both the outlook for growth but also interest rates. Well, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates in 2018 and 19. They were reducing the size of their balance sheet and choking off liquidity. They were worried about the potential for inflation. And they were worried that the overvaluation that was beginning, that could potentially arise from the fiscal stimulus. Well, they're not worrying about that anymore. In fact, they've given up worrying about inflation altogether. They are no longer going to try and rely on their expectations for future inflation. And maybe that's a good thing. The market has also been particularly bad at attempting to forecast what interest rates would look like. Whenever interest rates are falling, they think that they're going to stay steady. Whenever they're going steady, they think they're going to rise. And when they're falling again, they thought they were going to go sideways. Now everybody thinks they're going to go sideways. Maybe they're going to be wrong again. But one thing we've certainly seen is that the Federal Reserve has stopped predicting. They're going to wait for evidence. That means that they are going to allow inflation to rise and stay high in order for them to even begin to think about raising interest rates. I think that is one of the biggest factors that helps to clearly demonstrate that we are at the beginning of a new credit cycle where interest rates are likely to be held down for a prolonged period. But the big question is, that is what the central banks of the world want to do. And will investors play ball? That, I think, is by far the most important question in here today. We can certainly see that the commodity sector is doing well, and I will certainly put some of those charts up in a moment. We can see that small caps are doing better, that large caps have been doing well. IPOs and technology stocks continue to do well. But all of that is predicated on investors being willing to tolerate the debasement of fiat currencies, the willingness of governments to throw caution to the wind and engage in outright debt monetization. We tend to see these kinds of events perhaps once or twice in a lifetime. And we're seeing it again now, and the last time we had significant debt monetization was in the early 1970s. We've also seen that we've had a very significant uptick in social unrest, and the USA in particular is extremely divided along political lines and divided across states as well. But the rise of populism is something that has been going on now for a good long time. Narendra Modi in India was the first of the new batch of populist leaders, and we've seen so far that each one of these successful populist leaders has been rightward leaning. So they have championed free markets, capitalism, and lower regulation and lower taxes. There is the clear potential that when people do not get the results they want, which is rising living standards and less burdens from debt and greater opportunity, then they will lurch in the other direction, because populists are very good at making big promises. And the big promises that we have on the left today are that there's going to be a Green New Deal, there is going to be a carbon neutral strategy that's going to transition the economy away from dirty pollutants to a panacea of wonderful green technologies. We're going to have reparations for slavery. There is going to be universal basic income, that the very minimum, that minimum wages are going to be raised universally to $15. All of these promises are being made. They are extremely attractive to people who are ticked off with their place in life, and this is the beginning of the lurch backwards towards and to the other side. It's quite likely that we're going to see a lurch to the left. And if the USA is one of the first to do that, we'll see what happens with the election. But it's a rising possibility just about everywhere, and not least as the negative repercussions of spending way beyond our means don't turn up in a timely manner. When we think about what the argument is about modern monetary theory, they basically make the clear point that you can spend as much as you want. It doesn't matter how much currency you print, as long as you don't get inflation. Well, that is pretty much where we are today, because the spending programs that are being promoted, whether it is 1 trillion, 2 trillion, 3 trillion, 4 trillion, it is all with these massive numbers attached. There are universal basic income experiments going on all over. And all of this also is an attempt to try and answer the question, what do we do with people who have been displaced by digitization? There was millions of people lost their jobs as a result of globalization. But increasingly, we are looking at the potential that people will be displaced by digitization. The digital economy and the march of technology is all about dematerialization. In other words, taking something that exists in the world and completely replacing it with something that exists in the ether. What we've also seen over the course of the last while has been this incredible revolt against the police force. There is the potential that we're going to see much greater efforts to try and take people out of policing. When, for example, we think about the kinds of problems that arise as a result of an armed police force and an armed civilian force, then that does obviously create a volatile situation. What police forces are now starting to do is to use drones instead of police officers. Now, of course, that does not necessarily mean that there is less of a risk of difficulty, but what it does do is it reduces risk for individual police officers, and by extension, then that means that there will be fewer bullets, in fact, shot. So they're just beginning to use drones to do potential or to make the first steps in apprehensions. And of course, if you can do that with a drone, then you don't need quite as many police officers. So then the question is, what do you do with all those police officers? These are significant, I think, major evolutions in terms of the way the technology is being used, not only to provide a better solution, a safer solution, but it's also going to represent a very significant pressure on the kinds of jobs that people can, in fact, attain. When we think about driving, this is by far the most high profile of the big questions. General Motors Cruise offshoot made an application to the government today to say that they want to start building cars that do not have pedals or a steering wheel. So they are only just after getting permission to have five autonomous vehicles driving around in San Francisco. Now they want to start manufacturing cars with no pedals or driving seat, or excuse me, steering wheel. So obviously they are trying to move extraordinarily quickly in order to provide their autonomous taxi service. Well, that is potentially the way that car companies are going to survive in future. They're going to move progressively towards a service-oriented business model rather than a sales-oriented business model. And that's really a very different model. But it's obviously something that is going to require fewer vehicles, but or that vehicles may be then encouraged to last longer and be more reliable, because it would be the companies themselves would in fact be driving them. Of course, if we have autonomous vehicles, then there would be a lot more rides, because the only thing limiting the number of rides today is the time required by each individual person to in fact perform the ride. So the number of potential functions would increase substantially. Well, then that would create jobs in terms of loading and offloading and other service potentials for autonomous vehicles. But the 3% of people that are employed directly as drivers, then they're going to be completely without work. So what then do we do with those people? And this is one of the big problems that all of I was in an Uber yesterday. The Uber driver was incredibly enthusiastic about Uber. He was telling me that he makes between $250 and $300 a day from working about 10 hours a day, and he generally works 4 days a week. He has his own plans for starting a ride-hailing service, and he was talking about patenting the name of his new venture. He thought that the potential to get massive support from private equity to for his venture was only a matter of clicking his fingers. So Obviously, there are lots of people who are enthused by their ability to make money from ride-hailing services. The problem for ride-hailing services is they don't make enough money to pay these people, and the only route to profitability really is autonomy. But the ride-hailing services themselves are unlikely to be the companies that in fact provide the autonomy. So there is a race on to provide autonomous driving, and I think it's probably a lot closer to fruition than people believe, considering that people thought it was imminent in 2017. Well, we're 3 years on now, and we're certainly getting increasing potential, or getting beta testing going on with Tesla right now. Then you've got GM, and then of course there is Waymo, which is owned by Google. There was a kerfuffle at the beginning of the week about the Department of Justice moving towards antitrust for Google, and it was such a limited case, and I think largely concluded by investors that it was more electioneering than anything else. Then the share has rebounded and it continues to hold the region of the trend mean. I think one of the other important points about Google is it didn't IPO until well after the tech bubble, and it was in 2004. Well, when we think about the kinds of solutions that are coming through today, I think perhaps we are looking today at the same kind of phenomenon that it is that Google represented back in 2004. The growth potential of the company was probably not appreciated by the majority of people back then, and it was one of the biggest IPOs ever at the time. And also occurred at a point in the cycle where there weren't many people going for IPOs. Perhaps the autonomous vehicle sector is in a similar condition today, that by the time we get out to 2035, it is going to be everywhere, that we're likely to see this incredible advance in terms of what is possible, and it will look back and think about how people just didn't really believe the hype when it was first initiated. But the prize is so large that, and because it is a programming question rather than a question of physical infrastructure, this is exactly the kind of problem that will submit to brute force and very clear programming capability. That's also why there are so many companies that are attempting it, because the barrier to entry is comparatively low. The access to the data is by far the most valuable resource, and in that regard, Tesla has got more data than anybody else. So there's the clear potential that it will be Tesla, will in fact be the company that gets to autonomous first. It's of course a massive productivity enhancement, and it is the kind of innovation that will create a secular bull market, and it's one of the things that will continue to support the evolution of the technology sector. When we then think about what exactly is likely, then we're probably looking at the same kind of hollowing out in the stock market as we've had in the or in the lives of people, where there's been this massive hollowing out of the middle classes. Because the basic resources sector is certainly firming up. Then, when we think about the soft commodities, well, soybeans have been doing really very well and were stronger again in here today. There is an element of cyclicality to these kinds of moves. We can see that it does tend to do well at various stages, there was a clear, this was a good chart in here today highlighting Chinese demand for soybeans, and it does tend to peak around this time of the year. So the big question then will be whether soybeans can in fact hold this 1,000 cent level as it continues to do well from here. When we think about where are we then in the cycle, well, it would be logical to conclude that governments all over the world are spending so much money that the one thing they can't potentially tolerate is failure. They need to achieve reflation and escape velocity for growth, because that is the only possible way they're going to ever be able to pay back the debts that have been accumulated. So there is likely to be a very clear ambition to spur a reflationary trade as we head into 2021 and 2022. When we then think about what that is going to look like in terms of the wider economy, well, we're likely to see continued demand for just about all commodities, whether that is soybeans or coffee, wheat or corn. We're also likely to see renewed demand for industrial resources. And if the demand for electric vehicles continues, then that represents a secular change in terms of demand. The temptation would be to think that you can't have a commodity-led bull market without a new source of big demand coming through, like a big country like China. China was the introduction, or its introduction to the global markets in the early 2000s, and the spectacular demand growth that represented was the animating factor behind the big commodity bull market last time. What we may be looking at instead on this occasion is a global migration to renewable energy. And considering the fact that Europe is deadly serious about spending upwards of 2 trillion on its Green New Deal, the Chinese are also talking about becoming carbon neutral by 2050. And if the Democrats win a clean sweep in the USA, well, then the USA will also implement a Green New Deal. And that represents massive demand for all forms of renewable energy commodities, whether that is the rare earth metals that go into the wind turbines, whether it is silver and silicon that go into the solar panels, or whether it is the and this is a point I've been making for a long time. It's that when we think about natural gas and the very low price that it's trading at relative to all other energy commodities, then it's absolutely inevitable that we're going to see people come up with new ways to use it. And that's exactly what's happening with the hydrogen sector. Hydrogen represents a new source of demand for the massive supply of natural gas that is coming into the market from all over the world. There has been massive investment in additional sources of natural gas, and the evolution of a global LNG sector. What we've started to see is that Royal Dutch Shell is beginning to steady. It's been one of the companies that invested most in new natural gas supply. So, if we are going to move towards more of a hydrogen fuel cell driven economy, and certainly there's a lot of money pushing it, then demand for natural gas in the short term is likely to continue to rise. Eventually, the technology will improve enough that the production of hydrogen can take place without reforming natural gas and can be done without fossil fuels at all. But that technology doesn't exist yet. So that suggests that it is probably too early to write off the big, not big major, or I guess the major energy companies, but particularly Exxon and Royal Dutch Shell, because they have spent the most and have the greatest supplies of natural gas. They both produce more natural gas than oil. Oil prices continue to hold around the $40 area. When we then think about what's happening with gold, it has been doing really very well over the course of this year. We've been in this process of consolidation now for the last few months. It's been, sorry, holding the region of $1,900 for the last 6 weeks. It was in mildly negative territory over the last couple of days. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that it could have a brief period of weakness that would unwind its overbought condition relative to the trend mean, but the longer it goes sideways, the more that trend mean will rise to approximate the price. But rather than be focused on this process of consolidation that's going on right now, I think it's more important to just pay attention to the fact that we're right in the region of the previous peak. And gold prices had not given up all of the advance. They spent a good long time putting in a base formation. They've rallied to exceed the peak. Now we're getting a process of consolidation in the region of the previous peak. It's a normal and natural place where we could expect consolidation prior to additional upside. I think the other point is that when we look at gold on a purchasing power parity basis, it's been ranging for a really very long time below the peak from 1980. This is a natural area where we might get at least some reticence to push on to new high ground, but it's probably only a pause. There is just no way that governments are going to pay back the debts that have been accumulated. They have to go for reflation. Reflation could potentially have a positive impact on the velocity of money. This index is not updated all that often, but we've had a profound acceleration lower in the velocity of money. And acceleration is a trend ending. And I think analyzing fundamental data on the basis of crowd psychology is it is a useful exercise, because when we get these kinds of accelerations, it changes the fundamentals. Big bull and bear markets change the fundamentals. And velocity of money has been falling since 1997. So 23 years on the downside, and it has massively accelerated. So we have had a profound increase in the supply of money. All we need is for growth to start to pick up, and velocity of money will recover. Even if it goes from 109 to 120, then that's a significant move. In order to combat inflationary forces, then they would have to withdraw some of the money supply. If they withdraw some of the money supply, it would crash the stock market. There's no way they can do that. There's nothing they can do to endanger the reflation of the global economy. And they want inflation. So that is more than likely what we're going to get. And it is, I think, the most likely scenario is that we're going to get a process of this inability to raise rates, and efforts clearly underway to try and stop rates from rising. So that then will create abundant liquidity and fuel additional upside for stock markets. Eventually, interest rates will have to rise because inflationary pressures pick up. And at that point, that's when a lot of the very interest rate sensitive sectors, and particularly the companies that are not making money, that's when they really come under pressure. What we can also think about is that in a reflation trade, where there is massive amounts of money being made available to build new infrastructure, to repurpose old infrastructure, and then also to try and get as many people back into work as possible, well, that's also likely to be really beneficial for the industrial sector and for the materials sector, because it's going to require a great deal of commodity production and building in order to build the alternative infrastructure, put the large numbers of people who desire affordable housing into new housing, to build out the 5G infrastructure, to truly make it possible to live anywhere. The one question that I had today that's sort of niggling at the back of my mind is this incredible move we've had in semiconductors. We've had this huge move, and particularly for Taiwan Semiconductor, but they shipped well in excess of 2 million units to Huawei this year, ahead of sanctions going into effect. I'm very curious as to how much of that was pulling sales forward from the future, and how much did that massive purchase of semiconductor equipment, did that influence the forecasts for what's possible in future? But the evolution of 5G, the rollout of autonomous vehicles, the clear prevalence of artificial intelligence and deep learning in trying to crack some of these intransigent problems, these are very significant trends that are likely to create bull market environments. Bull markets thrive on liquidity. And if we have a story and we have liquidity, then those are the recipes for a bull market. What we've also seen, and it's particularly relevant to this kind of discussion, is the reevaluation of intangible assets by fundamental investors. Over the last few years, ETFs, and which are basically implicit momentum strategies, have massively outperformed value strategies. The stock markets and growth strategies have also outperformed value. Well, this then creates a crisis of confidence. Is it that value no longer works and that there are these new markets that we have to pay attention to? So the answer is going to be either value still works and valuations will eventually mean revert. In that case, those value investors will not do anything, but they're going to have difficulty holding on to their investors. Then you've got the other people that say, well, we must be wrong. There's a new way of analyzing markets. There's these things called intangible assets, and that's where all the value is coming from. So we need to incorporate intangible assets into our valuation metric. Then that allows value investors to buy these high-profile companies. So this is another step on the road towards a mania, where bull markets thrive on liquidity, and bull markets thrive on encouraging new sources of demand off the sidelines it into the market. So that's exactly what is happening. We're seeing this rationale and this way of thinking change that is encouraging more people to participate. So there is the clear potential then that we're also going to move into a bubbly environment. And that is also what the chart action is telling us. But that is incredibly interest rate sensitive. That entire way of thinking about private assets, IPOs, intangible assets, and the kind of investment and momentum strategies that have been working for the last decade, it's all highly interest rate sensitive. So the willingness of governments and central banks to continue to print more money is the basis for the continued strength in the stock market. What we're starting to see, though, is that gold is reflecting the other side of that trade, and that is likely to also persist because it's unlikely that governments are going to ever do anything to avoid trying to inflate the massive debts away. The big challenge from this perspective is what happens with government bond yields. If we're in a period of financial repression, then they could fix the yields. And then we would see a much greater exaggeration of the bull market in gold, but then also mass speculation. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. I wish all the best to all of you.